We'll do it live!
Fuck it!
Good evening and welcome to the Cosmic Highway Patrol, coming at you from the outskirts of Brevard County, Florida, USA. I am your host, Matt Chouinard, and thank you for joining me. So real quick, right up top, I'm going to be putting out an episode every other week with an occasional mini episode in between to cover the things I may have missed or didn't have time to cover in previous episodes. With that said, let's get into tonight's topic. What do you think of when you hear the phrase unidentified flying object? What comes to mind? Flying saucers and little green men from outer space? Proof of an extraterrestrial life? Maybe swamp gas or top secret man-made objects? I personally believe in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. It's a great big universe out there. In fact, there are as many as 30 galaxies just like ours around the Milky Way. And I find it hard to believe that we are the only intelligent life in the universe. And if you're religious, even Pope Francis doesn't discredit the possibility of intelligent beings on other worlds. A UFO is defined as a mysterious object seen in the sky for which it is claimed no orthodox scientific explanation can be found, meaning if you see something in the sky and you don't know what it is, it's a UFO. The thing about that, though, is there is a logical explanation for 90% of all unidentified aerial phenomena. Skeptics often dismiss that in which they can't explain as swamp gas, ball lightning, or group hallucination. You can tell the difference between ball lightning and an intelligently operated craft. And any of these skeptics who jump to the group hallucination explanation are being just as dismissive as those assholes in the Flat Earth Society. As in, they'll say, "I don't know what it is, but it sure as hell isn't an alien spacecraft." To which you reply, "Well, how do you know?" And they'll say, "I just know." If you just left it at "you don't know what it is," then you'd sound more intelligent, at least entertaining the thought that there may be things out there that are beyond your explanation. Peasants in Middle Ages Europe had no concept of the existence of the Americas. Doesn't mean the Americas didn't exist, it just meant that particular knowledge was completely unknown to them. I hope that makes sense. Let's take a look at the Phoenix Lights, for instance. On the evening of March 13, 1997, a formation of strange lights appeared over the city of Phoenix, Arizona. During the first of two events that night, a V-shaped formation of bright lights was described as moving very slowly and silently across the state. The lights were witnessed by thousands as it lumbered in silence through the Arizona night sky. The second event happened several hours later. This time, the lights formed a straight line and remained stationary. Pictures and video were taken of both of these happenings. Now, the official explanation from the U.S. Air Force, the branch that runs things like the U.S. Space Force, claimed the lights were flares dropped from aircraft flying around the Barry M. Goldwater Range nearby. Many who witnessed the lights could smell that bullshit from low Earth orbit. This explanation from the Air Force was deemed unsatisfactory to many, considering the fact that those who witnessed the first events all agree the lights seemed to move in an intelligently controlled manner. The theory regarding flares was replicated in a similar pattern soon after. It was quite evident to all watching that the flares, though roughly in a line for a time, all eventually moved independently of one another. All right, come on, skeptics. What else you got? Ultralights. They theorized ultralights could have caused the lights. An ultralight is basically a go-kart hooked to a parachute powered by a big fan off the back. The only problem with that theory is, unless they were the Blue Angels of ultralight pilots and they were electrically powered, this simply could not happen. Period. We could keep burning through the possible causes of the lights until we finally get to a football-sized top-secret military aircraft that can move silently, an extraterrestrial piloted UFO, or simply that in which cannot yet be explained. Swamp gas and ball lightning aren't going to cut it anymore. And if it's a group hallucination, the city of Phoenix may need to check out its water supply. Alright, enough about the Phoenix lights. Ultimately, I think the fact that witnesses state the silent operation of these craft to be one of the more fascinating aspects of the sightings. On November 7, 2006, pilots, airline employees, and ground crew at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago had a daytime sighting of their own. Witnesses reported seeing a disc-shaped metallic object hovering over Concourse C, Gate 17, about 1,500 feet off the ground. The object was reported to be dark gray in color and saucer-shaped, remaining stationary in the air for a few minutes. One pilot even reported the object to the tower, having the tower supervisor witness the aircraft personally. Once the craft saw what it came to see, it silently shot up through the clouds, leaving a disc-shaped hole showing blue sky on an otherwise overcast day. The incident ended up receiving quite a bit of media attention, including a press conference with the FAA, who downplayed the event, suggesting the possibility of a weather phenomenon of some description. This, of course, was the Federal Aviation Administration grasping at straws trying to come up with why an unauthorized craft was just hanging out, hovering in a no-fly zone. Can't blame them, really. But let's be honest, 30-foot saucer-shaped metallic weather anomalies don't just magically appear, then disappear through the clouds, punching a hole in the cloud cover. Oddly, the investigations disclosed the disappearance of all air traffic control tapes from that day and that day only. What is the FAA covering up? There's a reason those recordings are missing, and it doesn't have anything to do with weather anomalies. Nothing. Skeptics hypothesized the object was nothing more than a traditional cop-out of being a weather balloon, a reflection of airport lights, or even being a conventional man-made aircraft. Tell me something. When was the last time anyone you know ever saw a weather balloon? Either on the ground or in the air? Doesn't matter. I'm just really curious. I'm going to be getting into the what man-made aircraft that have and or could be mistaken for an alien spacecraft. It happens. It happens all the time. I'm not saying every UFO sighting is hard evidence of extraterrestrial life, by no means. I am saying that when a group of people witness an unidentified flying object that is clearly dark gray, metallic, and hovering silently, perhaps keep your stupid-ass weather balloon and light reflection theories to yourself. That's all. Alright, one more, then we'll get into the mistaken and potentially mistaken identity of man-made aircraft, then the theoretical engineering and origin of some of the many UFOs reported over the years. So on December 9th, 1965, a bright fireball was seen streaking through the sky and crashing into a wooded area in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. Those close to the crash site described the object as being shaped like an acorn and roughly the size of a car. Firefighters and police who arrived on the scene described the object as having strange hieroglyphic markings on the side. Soon after, military personnel arrived on the scene with a flatbed truck and recovered the crashed object. And though the military claimed that nothing particularly unusual had crashed, many conspiracy theories have emerged over the years theorizing everything from the object being a crashed Russian satellite, to a crashed alien spacecraft, to being a crashed Nazi time machine known as Die Glocke. Die Glocke, or the Bell, is presumably a figment of World War II mythology. This particular piece of Nazi technology was supposedly built and tested at a top-secret Nazi laboratory in Poland toward the end of the war. This device was supposedly built using exotic alloys and a power source that we have yet to re-engineer. The purpose of Die Glocke was to be able to travel through space and time using anti-gravity technology and powered by energy sources that are well beyond my pay scale. But I digress. The The crashed object in Kecksburg that night could very well have been a number of things. Throughout the late 50s and into the 60s, both the Soviets and Americans were flinging anything and everything they possibly could into the Earth's orbit in hopes of progressing their space programs. For more info on that, go back to the Moon episode for more info on the space race. The crashed satellite theory is quite possible. The shape and the size of the object could theoretically be a satellite, and I can see how the Russian Cyrillic alphabet could be mistaken for unknown writing by someone who's never seen Russian text. But both space rocks and man-made satellites alike often burn up upon re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. Space capsules containing astronauts and cosmonauts are built specifically not to burn up upon re-entry. But even then, they have to enter the atmosphere at just the right angle and speed in order to land safely. This object had no windows or doors and was found completely intact. It could have been man-made, but if that's the case, what was it and why was no official explanation given? Was it something from out of this world? Or was it just petrified ball lightning that the government didn't think the public could handle knowing the existence of? Either way, unless some file from the government on this event leaks out, we probably will never know what crashed in the woods outside of Kecksburg on that December night. So what if people seen in the skies that were man-made but mistaken for otherworldly spacecraft? The most alien-appearing aircraft the U.S. has in its fleet is the B-2 Spirit. This fast-moving black flying wing is the most unconventional aircraft to date. Nicknamed the Boomerang, the B-2's unconventional shape make it an incredibly effective long-range stealth bomber. The sleek design of the aircraft lacks any vertical surfaces, and sitting just 17 feet at its highest point when on the ground. This design feature makes radar detection very difficult, along with being constructed with and being coated by radar-absorbent composites and paint that minimize radar detection. Add to all that the fact that the engine's exhaust outlets are designed to direct the engine's exhaust in a way that reduces heat signatures that would be picked up by infrared and heat-seeking missiles. Put all that together and you have a crazy-ass technologically advanced death machine that is virtually invisible to enemy radar and countermeasures. I'd love to see one of these in person, but I'm thinking that privilege is highly unlikely. If there is any military aircraft that would be mistaken, it's this thing. The B-2's first flight was in July of 1989, and I can only imagine the number of 911 calls happening in the Southwest around this time. Now, I know I showed some love to the F-4 Phantom in my Vietnam episode, but the SR-71A Blackbird is without question tied for first as my favorite aircraft ever. The sheer badassery simply cannot be overstated. Looking at this thing from any angle, it looks like a spaceship. First flown in December of 1964, the SR-71 is an absolute marvel of engineering. To this day, it still holds numerous records, including absolute speed record, where on July 28, 1976, an SR-71 hit Mach 3.3, which is about 2,193 miles an hour. On the same day, the plane set a manned aircraft record, reaching an altitude of 85,069 feet, or about 16.1 miles above sea level. In 1990, the SR-71 flew from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. in 1 hour and 4 minutes and 20 seconds. Absolutely hauling ass. The Blackbird was constructed almost entirely of titanium and various composites, and the cockpit windshield was made of quartz. This was done mainly for heat resistance, as the windshield temperatures could get as high as 600 degrees Fahrenheit, and the outer skin of the aircraft would reach up to 800 degrees Fahrenheit due to air friction during high-speed flight. This thing was incredibly advanced for the time, that time being 59 years ago as of this recording. If they had all that knowledge of aerodynamics, engineering, and reconnaissance, it really makes you wonder how they got all that know-how so quickly after figuring out the jet engine. There are some who believe that the post-war technology explosion from the late 40s to the late 60s was due to the acquisition of alien technology from downed spacecraft. Things like the transistor, fiber optics, and night vision, just to name a few, are speculated to have been recovered from crashed UFOs. When you look at it, a lot of the tech that we rely on today was mostly developed in this small window of time. Not to put too fine a point on it, but it is interesting to think about. So how would this technology have been used in an extraterrestrial spacecraft? Where would it have come from? And more importantly, who would be operating it? Who knows? We can only speculate. I've seen every episode of Ancient Aliens, I've watched Chariots of the Gods countless times. UFO Hunters and UFO Files are incredibly sensational. There is no objective truth in the latter shows, as their goal is to show that there is unequivocal proof of extraterrestrial life because some asshole with Photoshop made a weird picture of a flying object. So, bam! Aliens are real. One thing scientists all seem to agree on is the theory that UFOs would need to be powered by some kind of anti-gravity technology or a nuclear-based propulsion system using exotic physics like warp drives or wormholes. We already have the technology to build an ion drive, and theoretically, they are very efficient for traveling long distances at high speeds. The problem with the ion drive is the time it takes to accelerate using the drive system. It's a little less Lamborghini and a little more Mack truck in its capabilities. UFO witnesses have stated the time and time again just how fast these crafts accelerate out of sight. Some scientists theorize that in order to accelerate from standstill to thousands or even ten thousands of miles per hour without liquefying the occupants with the G-forces, you need something different altogether. Something like ripping a hole in space-time in front of the craft and using something like an antimatter propulsion system to accelerate the crafts to insane speeds that we, as humans, can only theorize in a laboratory setting. Antimatter is made up of antiparticles, which have the same mass as a regular particle except with an opposite charge. When antimatter comes in contact with matter, they destroy one another and turn the matter into pure energy by way of Einstein's E equals mc² theory of relativity. Think of antimatter and matter as magnets. But instead of negative and positive poles sticking together, each particle has an explosion. An engine harnessing this kind of power could very easily move a 20-foot diameter disk very fast, very quickly. The theoretical problems with antimatter are obtaining and storing the particles as a fuel source. The container would essentially have to be made of a material that is neither matter nor antimatter, a composite or element that we currently have no idea how to make or to produce in any quantity. So now we have our power plant in place, shooting ions, pure energy, or plasma out of the back. What is the structure of this craft going to be made of? The airframe of the SR-71 is made up almost entirely of titanium to withstand the heat and rigors of travel through the atmosphere at over 3 times the speed of sound. The titanium skin got so hot on the plane that it grew 9 inches longer during flight than on the ground due to the expansion of the titanium from the heat. Witnesses have reported these crafts traveling faster than this, much faster, making perfect 90-degree turns and being invisible to radar. How could any spacecraft or its occupants possibly withstand these kind of conditions? Some theorize that composites unknown to us are used for heat resistance and rigidity. Plain and simple, right? Well, perhaps. If your average garden variety warp drive system is used, there is a theoretical possibility that the heat generated by wind resistance could be null and void. A warp drive propulsion system is a theoretical concept that has been popularized in science fiction, most notably by Star Wars and Star Trek. And yes, I know it's called hyperdrive in the Star Wars universe, so all you Star Wars nerds can stop typing the "well, actually" emails before you start. Love you, Star Wars nerds. The theories are essentially the same. By shrinking space-time in front of the craft, and expanding space-time behind the craft, it would be theoretically possible for an object to travel faster than the speed of light. Now, before I go any further, I know I've been using the words theoretically, theorize, and theory an awful lot because, as of right now, that's all they are. Theories. And before all you naysayers say nay, just keep in mind that over the past 100 years or so, science fiction as a genre has driven the development and expansion of technology. Try explaining the concept of a television to Abraham Lincoln, or the concept of a stealth bomber to the Wright brothers in 1900, or explain to anyone in 1990 how a smartphone works. At one point, everything in our lives was nothing more than a concept or a theory. Terraforming Mars is still science fiction, but they are currently gearing up at the Space Center right now to start sending crews to the Red Planet. Pretty exciting stuff. I just wonder how many Mars hoaxers there will be in the coming decades. These are the people who wouldn't believe in intelligent extraterrestrial life until one was brought back tied up in the trunk of a space capsule or landed a UFO on the White House lawn. And honestly, to that I say, I don't necessarily blame you. But it can be fun sometimes to think outside the box. That is how our modern world was and is developed. Moving right along. So now that we touched upon the what and the how, the who and the where kind of go hand in hand. The closest Goldilocks zone or habitable zone is around Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star to planet Earth, which is situated around 4.24 light years away. A light year, for those who don't know, is the distance it would take light to travel in 1 year through the vacuum of space, roughly 670,616,629 miles per hour, or about 5.88 trillion miles. Multiply that by 4.24 and you get 24.93 trillion miles to the next possible habitable zone. It's a long way away, so it's theoretically possible that a human-like race can reside there, and who knows, they may know about us, or worse, deny the possibility of our existence. When you start talking extraterrestrials and alien races, a lot of wacky shit pops up amongst the conspiracy theorists. The main ones being the Greys, with the big heads, the almond-shaped black eyes, that are here for scientific research with their probes and all that. The reptilians, that only want to harvest and exploit the human race. And the Nordics, who are a much more benevolent race. Though I don't know for sure, I'd have to imagine that it would be theoretically possible for there to be more than one alien race. And I suppose if they evolved in much the same way we did only a few million or even a billion years before us, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that being that far ahead of us, they would be able to develop technology needed to travel great distances quickly and reliably. I'm going to be getting a little more into the theories of wormholes and other dimensions in a future episode of the Mandela Effect. But I mean, all this is speculation and theories right now. No one really knows for sure. Or does somebody know? There is a guy named Bob Lazar who claims to have worked on reverse engineering alien technology at a place called S4 near Area 51. In 1989, Lazar told his story to the investigative reporter George Knapp, claiming to have been hired as a physicist to reverse engineer an alien spacecraft at the government facility. According to Lazar, he was tasked with working on the propulsion systems of the spacecraft, specifically those that were powered by an antimatter reactor. He claimed these spacecraft were extraterrestrial in origin, containing technologies well beyond human capabilities. Lazar's claims have stirred up incredible controversy and interest amongst the conspiracy theory and UFO communities. Unfortunately, there are some details and aspects of Lazar's education and background credentials that just don't add up. This would include a lack of any kind of corroborating evidence of his employment history with the government agencies. In spite of all that, Bob Lazar's story has remained a very notable part of UFO and conspiracy theory lore and a benchmark in discussions about extraterrestrial technology and government secrecy. I don't know. I think there's something out there, and I think someone knows about it. That's my take. Perhaps some government facility in the desert has possession of an alien craft with technology and capabilities light years beyond our understanding. So what do you think? Do you believe in extraterrestrial life and their ability to travel to Earth from wherever they came from? Or maybe we are the only intelligent life forms in the black, empty sea of nothingness we call the universe? Let me know what you think at CosmicHighwayPatrol@gmail.com or CosmicHighwayPatrol on Instagram. This has been a fun one. I'm going to cover UFOs and aliens more in the future, as the subject is far too broad to cover in just one or even a couple episodes. As always, I'd like to thank everyone listening, because otherwise I'd just be sitting here in front of a mic talking to myself. That does it for me. I'm out of here. Good night and take care.